Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. The UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan has entered its second week. This year's conference is once again being held in an autocratic petrostate, where at least 1,773 coal, oil, and gas lobbyists have been granted access, according to the Kick Big Polluters Out Coalition. Those lobbyists outnumber the delegations of almost every country at the conference. This comes as 2024 is almost certain to be the hottest year on record, and heat waves, floods, droughts, and hurricanes have caused death and destruction across the globe. Scientists say the United States and other major economies must rapidly transition away from oil and gas to avert even more death and destruction. Joining us to talk about all of this and the summit is Bob Berwin, a climate science and international climate policy reporter for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit news organization focusing on environmental journalism. In a recent piece, Bob Berwin writes, "If speeches and slogans could save the climate, COP29 would already be a success. But there are few signs the current round of climate talks will deliver on the only thing proven to slow global warming, rapid greenhouse gas cuts. Global heating is already approaching 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial baseline, a level at which scientists say some dangerous climate feedback loops are likely to kick in and accelerate warming even more. By some estimates, Donald Trump's plans to promote fossil fuels could add 4 billion tons of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere by 2030, about equal to the amount produced annually by the world's 140 lowest emitting countries. And according to so many scientists, we must drastically curb greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2030. Bob Berwin joins us from Baku, Azerbaijan. Hi, Bob. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. It's a pleasure to be here again. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you back, Bob. Before we talk about this year's conference, can you tell us what you're hearing from attendees about the U.S. election? You know, as we have been saying for many, many months, as the climate crisis accelerates, the United States has again, well, we talked about what's at stake, has again chosen a climate crisis enabler to enter the Oval Office. In 2017, Trump pulled out of the U.S. Paris Climate Accord. His administration will once again be packed with people who are very connected to oil and gas. So what are you hearing from people about the U.S. election and Donald Trump?
There were definitely a lot of questions. The first couple of days especially, it's kind of quieted down now. And I get a sense that the rest of the countries are continuing to go about their business. I think some of the initial reactions were concern, shock, not just with regard to the climate, but for a host of other reasons as well, because, you know, this election sort of mirrors a trend in various countries scattered around the world toward more authoritarian governments and crackdowns on climate activists. And I think that's actually more disturbing than the actual effect on climate. The 4 billion tons of carbon number sounds really high, yet another analysis that came out just a few days ago suggests that would add about 0.04 degrees Celsius of warming to what's already expected. So from a standpoint of the actual physical warming, it's perhaps not so much and could be compensated by other countries. It's perhaps more some of these other fringe effects of his election that might be more concerning, how it might affect other countries. For example, Argentina pulled its delegation from the climate talks just a couple of days after it started, at the orders of their president, Javier Milei, who follows sort of a similar philosophy that Trump does. He's also a climate denier. So far, no other countries have followed suit. He didn't withdraw Argentina out of the Paris Agreement or anything like that, just pulled his negotiators from these talks. But you can see how that might have a ripple effect. At the same time, I also get a sense that people are determined, environmental groups, climate advocates are determined to fight as hard as they can. There's a lot of hope, a lot of love, a lot of sadness and anger too when you talk to the folks that are there with civil society, the global environmental groups and smaller groups from, you know, hundreds of countries, literally more than 100 countries or 190 countries. And so it's a real mixed bag of emotions, I would say.
We should mention that on Thursday, Trump met with Argentine President Javier Milei at Mar-a-Lago. This is the first foreign leader that has met with him since the election. So that's pretty significant. You know, I just want to ask you one more question on this, because there's obviously a lot to criticize the Biden administration for on the climate crisis. We've done a lot of shows about that. What are you hearing from other countries about what it will mean to have someone like Trump in office? He will most likely pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement again and roll back so many regulations. What does that give other countries license to do, given what has happened in the United States and what we'll see over the next 4 years?
Well, again, what I've heard from other countries is a continued determination to work on this together and to continue on a path to reduce emissions and try and reach the goals of the Paris Agreement. You know, they are generally saying that Trump's decision will make that harder. There's no doubt about that. And it will affect other aspects of the climate crisis as well. This COP in Baku has been sort of billed as the finance COP, with the goal of really significantly increasing climate financing of all sorts. And even though the U.S. has not been pulling its weight in that area for years, it improved a lot under Biden, and that's all going to go away again under Trump. There will be no climate finance, direct climate finance from the U.S. under Trump. Remember, the U.S. is only 4% of the global population, so there's a huge world out there. And most countries are ready to continue working on this and working together, you know, to try and solve this problem. So along with disappointment and concern, there's also determination to keep on trucking.
You spoke with policy researcher Sonja Thielges with the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. She said she's concerned by proposals that could emerge under Trump to reorganize U.S. development aid to, quote, focus it entirely on fossil fuel development, especially in African countries. She said locking hundreds of millions of people into fossil fuel infrastructure for decades would be an absolute climate disaster. This is really important because now they have full control over U.S. development aid.
That's correct, but it's still up to the countries who are on the receiving end of that if they want to, use foreign aid for fossil fuel development or not. And it also opens up avenues for other countries, for the EU, for example, and for China to invest more on the renewable side of things. So that will be probably something that will be decided at individual country levels. And leading up to the conference, I also spoke to several climate and energy policy experts and researchers in a few different African countries. And the situation differs from country to country. There may be countries that are receptive to investing in more fossil fuel development. There are other countries that are just committed to a renewable energy path. So there's a lot that's still up in the air too, but that is definitely a concern. And as was written in the article, and as Sonia Tilges said, if it ends up locking in more fossil fuel infrastructure, it will lead to more greenhouse emission for decades to come.
Bob Berwin is a reporter with Inside Climate News. He's joining us from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Bob will be with us for 15 more minutes. So if you have any questions for Bob about what's happening at the climate conference, or any thoughts you'd like to share about Trump and the future of the climate crisis, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. I apologize once again. We're still trying to fix our phone lines. So for now, you can email us your thoughts, yourcall@kalw.org. So Bob, this year's summit is hosted by another autocratic petrostate. Azerbaijan's President Ilham Aliyev called the Western media fake news. He slammed environmental activists and NGOs and says his country should not be blamed for having fossil fuel reserves. He has described oil and gas as a gift from God. Why is this summit being held in Azerbaijan?
You want the short answer or the long answer?
Well, we've got about 13 minutes left.
It's the decision to where the decision to host the COPs is made sort of on a rotating basis by various regions designated by the United Nations. And this year was the turn for Eastern Europe. And those countries then consult amongst each other to pick one. And those discussions are not open to the public. They're often, those decisions are often made by phone calls and communications among individual country leaders. And in this case, what we reported last year was that out of this group of countries, which includes Russia, Hungary, Slovakia, Czechia, Romania, Bulgaria, etc., Russia was prepared to sort of veto any choice other than Azerbaijan. And that was based on geopolitical considerations involving Russia's aggression in Ukraine, as Azerbaijan is seen as somewhat more of an ally to Russia than many of these other countries who have joined in the effort to sanction Russia for its invasion and so forth. So that's how it ends up in Azerbaijan. And there have been calls for changing that process. Just a few days ago, a group of pretty high-profile climate leaders, including Christiana Figueres, who led the UN's climate effort up to the Paris Climate Agreement, wrote a letter saying that this selection process needs to be changed, that host countries should have to meet, you know, a basic set of criteria in order to be able to host a COP. And I'm not sure how much traction that's going to get, but it's the first time that it's been sort of brought into the spotlight right in the middle of a conference with the letter directed right at the UNFCCC. So hopefully they will, over the course of the next few years, consider some changes to that, as well as other aspects of the process. You mentioned the lobbyists in the intro. And it's interesting in researching for a couple of stories that are coming out in the next couple of days about reforming the COP process. I learned that the UNFCCC does not have a conflict of interest policy that sets out sort of clear rules for involvement by non-state stakeholders, such as fossil fuel companies and others. Other global negotiations, for example, the Global Tobacco Treaty, when it was negotiated, did not have tobacco company lobbyists attend those talks. And there are currently talks for a global pandemic treaty. And as I understand it, I don't know all the details yet, there are very strict limits on the involvement of pharmaceutical companies. So a lot of people are asking, wait, why don't we have these same kind of rules for fossil fuel companies and other industries at these climate talks?
So given that there are so many lobbyists there, the Guardian reports that there are at least 480 lobbyists working on carbon capture and storage. Would you say that these talks are still significant?
Yes, I would. I would say for a couple of reasons. One, before the Paris Climate Agreement, we were on track for global warming of something like, 5 to 7 degrees Celsius. And with the commitments that were made under the Paris Agreement, if they're lived up to, that now looks more like 2.7 to 2.9 degrees warming, which is still a horrible level of warming that we absolutely must avoid. But you can see that this has had a very tangible effect. Not fast enough, not enough yet, but it has. Secondly, these efforts have resulted in at least some climate financing to start flowing to developing countries. And again, it's far, far below what's really needed, but it's more than what was there before this process started. So there have been some small steps forward. And it's the only international process we have right now to tackle this problem. There are no other real options. It's a global problem that needs most countries in the world to buy into solutions. So a few folks told me in the course of reporting, given the geopolitical tensions and various political and economic problems in different countries, it's really quite remarkable that these countries still do come together once a year to talk about this. And it's easy to be cynical, and I fall into that trap. And at the same time, I see people who have devoted, decades to these negotiations, and they're people of goodwill, and they come to the table each year determined to make a difference as best they can, even if it's just small steps, as other factors allow.
Bob Berwin is a reporter with Inside Climate News. He's joining us from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. If you have any questions for Bob about the summit or what your thoughts are about the climate crisis with Trump returning to the White House, you can email us your call at kalw.org. We are still working on getting our phone lines fixed. The email is yourcall@kalw.org. Bob, every time we do shows about this climate conference, we talk about the activists who spend a lot of money flying from all corners of the globe to express themselves at this climate conference. What are your thoughts about the activists that you're seeing there, what they're doing? What are you hearing from them? And then I saw that there was a silent protest over the weekend because some of the activists said that they're not allowed to yell. Is that true?
Apparently there were quite some restrictions placed on activists within the conference itself. There are no protests out on the street surrounding the conference or in the city that I'm aware of or that have been permitted. As you mentioned, it's an authoritarian country, and that's sort of a continuing a trend of the last couple of years. It was the same in Dubai. There was nothing out on the streets in the city of Dubai itself, nor the year before in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. And I was indeed told that they were not allowed to do their normal chants that they do. What do we want? Climate justice. When do we want it? Now. So rather, they gathered in one of the main central areas yesterday, several hundred, and hummed and snapped their fingers and held up signs. And some of them had tape across their mouths to symbolize their being silenced, their voices being silenced. But I think their message still gets out to the delegates that are there. That's sort of their purpose. They're there to remind folks that this is a serious crisis. I do tend to spend a lot of time with the activists because, for one thing, it's the one thing that gives me hope, talking to the young people that are there who, you know, who love each other, who love the planet, who are committed to protecting nature, and determined to fight for this as long as they can. And so there are good things there too, and that does give me some hope.
So what are you hearing from the activists?
What am I hearing? Well, yeah. they're demanding, since the focus of this year's COP is climate finance, they're demanding that the delegates here reach an agreement that measures up to the need. So going from $100 billion per year to anywhere between $1 to $5 trillion per year, which is an aspirational goal. And we honestly have no idea where that's going to land right now. I just read a few minutes ago that they're sort of waiting for the end of the G20 meeting, and that will give some direction to what that final number might look like.
You quoted Leanne Shalatek, Associate Director of the Heinrich Böll Foundation in Washington, D.C. She says developing countries say at least $1 trillion is needed annually for the energy transition and for climate adaptation. She expects the U.S. to reverse that policy, and it'll make it harder to reach that goal. She says, if you know that there's no way the U.S. will participate and that whoever is there in terms of negotiators won't really have a mandate to negotiate anything, it's hard to see how you could entice countries that already feel that they're going to be stiffed to negotiate. So what about that? What are you hearing on that?
I'm hearing that the U.S. pulling out of climate financing definitely presents some additional challenges. The U.S. has as the world's largest historical greenhouse gas emitter, has, so to say, caused the greatest share of climate damages around the world and in the U.S. And so under a sort of a fairness doctrine, could be expected to be one of the largest contributors to climate financing. So it'll definitely leave a hole. And so the final number may not be as high as it would if the U.S. were willing to step up. But also don't forget that the U.S. has never really pulled its weight in terms of climate finance. The U.S. has not really been seen as a reliable partner in this climate process because, well, it's already pulled out of the Paris Agreement once. It rejected the Kyoto Protocol, which was the first climate agreement to come out of this UN process, requiring deeper greenhouse gas cuts by developing countries. So, you know, U.S. history in this process is a little sketchy to begin with. So the shock may not be quite as big as some people in the U.S. think it is.
And not sure if you can answer this question, Bob, but the economy of Azerbaijan relies almost entirely on fossil fuels. And Don writes, if the people are dependent on oil, what is the future of Azerbaijan?
I can't really answer that specifically to Azerbaijan, but the overall vision is for some of these fossil-dependent countries to also transition to renewable energy economies. And you asked earlier why this conference was held in Dubai last year and in Azerbaijan this year. This isn't a direct reason, but I think there's been, since the beginning of this process, a recognition that oil-producing countries have to be brought on board somehow, and that whatever agreements are reached have to offer them a path away from fossil fuels to some other energy system as well.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back. The conference is lasting one more week. Can you give us a sense of what's on the agenda this week? What are you expecting?
It's really focusing now these last few days. It's actually only 4 days of talks left officially. And it's really focusing on this global climate financing goal. That's really the big prize. A couple of other things. Next year, all countries that signed on to the Paris Agreement are obligated to deliver new national climate plans for emissions reductions. And so even though that's not a decision item on the agenda, it is being discussed all the time. What are those plans going to look like? How ambitious will they be? And will they add up to an amount of emissions cuts that get us closer to reaching that 1.5 degree target to limit warming to 1.5 degrees?
Bob Berwin is a climate science and international climate policy reporter with Inside Climate News. He joined us from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Thank you so much, Bob.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. We should also mention that the Committee to Protect Journalists calls for jailed Azerbaijani journalists to be freed. According to the CPJ's Gulnoza Said, with at least 15 journalists awaiting trial on charges that could see them jailed for between 8 and 20 years, Azerbaijan's treatment of the press is absolutely incompatible with the human rights values expected of a UN host country. CPJ calls on Azerbaijani authorities to release all unjustly jailed journalists and support press freedom. Coming up after a break, we will talk about Lee Zeldin, Donald Trump's pick to head the EPA. Inside Climate News reporter Marianne Lavelle writes, Zeldin brings a moderate face to a radical game plan. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this.